Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, Upstart Crow listeners, and welcome. I'm William Miller, and I have with me two guests, Jerry Mitchell and Robert E. Luckett, Jr. Jerry Mitchell, a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, worked for 3 decades for the Mississippi newspaper The Clarion Ledger, leaving in 2019 to found the nonprofit Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting, which is dedicated to exposing injustices, investigating cold cases, and giving voice to the voiceless. He has aligned recently with Mississippi Today, an online nonprofit news outlet that boasts one of the largest newsrooms in Mississippi. Jerry is the author of Race Against Time, in which he details his reporting while with the Clarion Ledger that led to reopening and convicting men accused in 4 major murder cases from the Civil Rights era. Robert E. Luckett, Jr. is a history professor at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, where he also directs the Margaret Walker Center and the COFO Civil Rights Education Center. He is the author of numerous scholarly articles and carefully researched works, including a book that focuses on Joe T. Patterson, the Mississippi Attorney General from 56 to 69. Robbie and that book were the focus of an earlier Upstart Crow episode. The book, Joe T. Patterson and the White South's Dilemma, Evolving Resistance to Black Advancement, offers a close read on the life and work of a dedicated white segregationist. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Be with you.
Dr. Rena Bliss, a sociologist on the faculty at Rutgers University, wrote that the human brain is, quote, plastic, always developing and growing as we learn from our environments. In addition, human intelligence, she says, relies on human interaction. What she is saying, essentially, is that people construct knowledge from experience, from education, from information, whatever the source. If it is constructed, it also is and can be deconstructed. Robbie, you've written about this. Through the years, people with diehard racist attitudes have criticized those who would compromise on integration, give a little ground, that is, perhaps. By virtue of some of those compromises, progress has been made, it would seem, and yet it also seems we're kind of in a period of resurgence, of resistance. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I would just say that I completely agree that this notion of knowledge as a construction, so much of our identities are constructed and can be reconstructed and deconstructed, as you say. I certainly espouse that as an idea and as a driving force in my own scholarship and the work that I do. And I think it's actually a point for some hope that not only can, as you say, we see some regression over time, but we can also see progress. And when I talk to groups about social justice movements, civil rights movement, the struggle for the recognition of basic human dignity, that throughout world history, not just American history, progress is something that ebbs and flows almost like the tides, right? We make great progress, that tide comes in, but then there's always reaction and ongoing resistance to that progress, and that tide flows back out. And so that ebb and flow of progress is part of kind of world history, and it's in those moments that these ideas, that power itself, continues to be constructed and reconstructed and is malleable. And it is, I think, in the end, again, a hopeful thing that we can make progress and that in a place like Mississippi, we can use as a lens to see where progress has been made, particularly over the last 50 to 60 years, even if there's still much work to be done and much resistance to that progress.
Jerry, in your work for the newspaper, those articles, they brought public attention to bear on 4 hugely important, well-known cases, including the murder of Medgar Evers here in Jackson, Mississippi, where we're recording this episode. But those cases, I mean, I've read in reading the book, you see how carefully you had to work to construct that knowledge and build that public awareness. Certainly, that was building public knowledge and awareness. Talk for a few moments, if you will, about that, because it was very clear that those murderers thought they were above the reach of the law.
Right. In fact, I'd say at the time they thought they were doing what was desired, the populace desired, certainly the white populace desired. Yeah, I just think that you pretty much have to have truth in order to have justice, and people have to be informed. I know I was woefully ignorant of much of what happened in the civil rights movement, other than just kind of the bare bones of it, when I came to Mississippi in 1986. And so I kind of began to get an education myself, like Medgar Evers. About all I knew about Medgar Evers when I started to write about him was there was a street in Jackson named after him, you know, and he was a civil rights leader and he'd been killed. I mean, that was literally about all I knew, and began to find out more about it. And of course, went and interviewed the killer himself, who lived in Tennessee. And, you know, those kinds of things, I think as a journalist, that kind of becomes our role in kind of to help inform the public, and therefore they can make intelligent decisions from that. And I think that's one of the things I see that's getting lost, is this area, a place where trusted news sources, or whatever you want to call them, that exist out there, you know, are providing this information. The public, you know, takes that in, and the public therefore is able to make decisions. But what I see now, unfortunately, is a proliferation of not really so trustworthy news sources out there, blogs or whatever they are. And yet people take them in and assimilate them as if they were. And it creates a lot of confusion. And to be frank, some of them are just lies. And then they're out there and people begin to believe the lies. And when you don't know the truth, and you really can't make a very good decision, I'll put it that way, if you're basing your information on a bunch of lies.
Let's stick with that theme for a moment. I know in your book, and I've seen other citations as well, there was talk about some of the beliefs. These were Christian gentlemen, these murderers were.
Yeah, they were, most of them, yeah.
And they believed a certain set of principles, but they also had some twists on some of that I, growing up as a Christian, never heard.
Yeah, well, Beckwith, the killer of Medgar Evers, Byron Deal of Beckwith, was a believer in what's called a Christian identity. And this is kind of a white supremacist take on Christianity. You know, it's not mainstream Christianity at all. But they believed that Adam and Eve were white people, and they believed that all the non-white races were were like animals. They were created on the sixth day, and they didn't have souls. You know, it's pretty sick. And it was very anti-Semitic as well. You know, believed that Jews were the offspring of Satan and things like that, just ridiculous things that they believed. But he believed it fervently, I will tell you, having sat with him for 6 hours.
Yeah. So one thing, I mean, that was then, this is now, but when you talk about things being out there on the internet, on social media, I mean, the system of beliefs may or may not change or have in certain ways, but and how we perpetuate it, the speed of dissemination is certainly a lot faster, perhaps, but I don't know that the weirdness has gone away.
No, I would say the weirdness has not gone away. It's unfortunate. In fact, some of the things that Beckwith talked to me about, which seemed so radical, I interviewed him in 1990, April of 1990, and actually some of the things he said that seem so out there now are kind of coming in back into the mainstream. Things like fluoridated water, and, you know, he talked to me all about fluoridated water being a communist plot, and just all sorts of things like that. And now all of a sudden there's all this discussion about fluoridated water and different things like that, that I really was surprised. I'm surprised to see, you know, come into the mainstream discussion.
What goes around comes around. But things have changed in a sense. I mean, I think some of the reasons that the convictions happened in the cases that you covered is the fact that jury composition altered.
Yes.
Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, well, when for example, when Beckwith went on trial for the Mega Rivers murder in 1964, not only were they all white juries, because African Americans were in general barred from serving. All you understand is where they get jury rolls from. They get them from voting rolls. So that's where those names come from. And therefore, African Americans were being barred from voting. So therefore, their names, for the most part, weren't on the voting rolls. And even if they were immediately kicked off. And so you had an all-white jury that was also all-male, because women were not allowed to serve on juries in Mississippi until 1968.
And in the Emmett Till case, that jury deliberated for a little over an hour.
Yeah, a little over an hour, and they came back and said they wouldn't have taken so long, but they stopped to have a Coke.
Right. And in a magazine article that the men sold, they later said they basically did it.
They basically admitted they did it. Yeah, it's a long story about Huey and that story. But yeah, that's William Bradford Huey who wrote that piece. But yes.
Let's delve into the Emmett Till case. It's fairly well known. And as the late John Lewis said, Emmett Till was his George Floyd. And I think a lot of people relate to the George Floyd case. One of the things that is interesting to me is the distances between the places that are involved in the Emmett Till case.
Yes.
He was abducted from a house early Sunday morning.
Correct.
The event itself happened, and when I say distances, both time and geography. The event happened like Thursday. He was abducted early Sunday.
The Wednesday night was the store.
Okay. Wednesday night was the store in money. And then
the abduction was basically early Sunday morning, like about 2 a.m. or okay. So the
two gentlemen.
Yeah, gentlemen. Killers.
The two killers built up that rage.
And there were more than two, by the way.
Ultimately. But the witnesses at the house from which he was abducted cited two. There may have been more people in the vehicle, the truck.
There were. In fact, they identified that as well.
They drove him for half an hour to the barn where he was tortured and killed. They then, after he was dead, drove him for another half an hour before disposing of his body with a fan motor tied to it by barbed wire, and they dumped him into the Tallahatchie River.
Yeah, they dumped him in, and that whole narrative that's in the Huey story, we now realize a lot of it is not true. Hmm. So there was a lot of driving around in the Huey story that's not really true, but they had to account for the time, So anyway, yeah. But they did dispose of the body, did throw him in. The FBI believes he was probably thrown in around Glendora. That's where J.W. Mile and one of the killers lived. And so they believe he probably threw him into the river there and then floated downstream into the Tallahatchie.
Robbie, that's a long way to maintain that much anger.
Yeah. And at some point, once they committed to doing this, there was no backing out, right? And it started maybe not necessarily a slippery slope, but it started a series of events that led to this story, this horrible kidnapping and murder of a 14-year-old boy. And it's rooted, it's a long way to carry hate, but that hate was built and rooted in a society that had been building a power structure that supported a white supremacist terrorist regime, I would argue, in Mississippi. And they were simply expressions of that. And that had been building for 150 years, maybe back to the end of the American Civil War, I guess 100 years by the time of Emmett Till, if not before. And so there was something ingrained around white supremacy in these two killers, that they were immersed in it and they grew up with it, and it was absorbed into their consciousness in a way that it was natural for them to act upon. And I don't know how much effort it required of them to maintain that anger and hatred, because it was all they had ever known.
And, you know, it was kind of like the lawyer who talked to William Bradford Huey. He kind of explained it, which I thought actually was a pretty good explanation from that kind of white supremacist standpoint, was we have to have our Milams and Bryants to fight our wars and beat up our N-words and things like that. I mean, that was kind of the mentality. You know, the idea being that the white-collar bankers and lawyers and stuff, they weren't going to get their hands dirty, but they needed these other guys to take care of this kind of violence.
It's the very kind of general distinction that we see in civil rights history socioeconomically between what's often described the Citizens Council as being versus the Klan as being. Although we know membership could overlap between the two. You could certainly be in both.
Oh, they were.
Absolutely. But generally, the Citizens Council seen as the higher class, white elite, who are kind of driving everything, and then the Klan, the poorer working class whites, who were co-opted into believing that their whiteness made them better than somebody, even if they were never going to be as good as kind of the white elite in the state.
Yeah, that's with the old Bob Dylan song, you know, Only a Pawn in Their Game, which is about Meg Rivers' assassination. It said, you know, Dylan's lyrics are, he's just a pawn in these white politicians' game. Only a pawn in their game. So it's just...
And it's also why so many of those white lawyers came to their defense.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
Wanted to make sure that they would be acquitted.
Yeah, and Beckwith had three lawyers that came to him courtesy of the White Citizens Council, of which he was a member, and they represented him for free. So those are the kind of things that were going on at the time. That really, it was kind of a protection of that system.
Let's go into those cases just for listeners and make sure that we covered. So in 1964, the murders. In 1964, there were the three
civil rights workers. Sometimes called the Mississippi Burning case, which that's what the FBI called it.
And there was a movie.
Yeah, and there was a fictional movie about it as well.
There was Medgar Evers, probably one of the best known cases.
Right.
And that was in 1963.
There was also a movie about it, although much less seen, Ghost of Mississippi.
Vernon Dahmer?
Dahmer, yes.
He was a voter registration organizer.
Yes, basically.
He was a merchant and was offering to let black people pay their voter registration fee, and he would collect the form and plan to turn it in. White people, supremacists, saw that as a threat.
Right, and so the Klan attacked him and his family. He basically died defending his family from a Klan attack. That was actually after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, kind of interestingly. It was in January of 66.
Right.
But before poll taxes were declared unconstitutional.
Correct, in state elections.
Right.
So they had already been banned in federal, but not in state.
But not in the state.
Yeah, so.
And then the fourth case was the Birmingham 16th Street Baptist Church bombing.
Yeah, the four little girls that were killed.
Definitely innocent victims.
Oh, absolutely.
Didn't do anything to bring that on themselves.
No, I mean, the Klan was upset because they've been doing, everybody's seen the photographs and footage of Birmingham, the spring of 63, the fire hoses and the dogs and all that. Well, it was a children's march they were reacting to, and the children marched out of the 16th Street Baptist Church. So that was their animus. They were essentially trying to, strike a blow against the movement.
And, Robbie, you have said to me privately that one of the reasons all this happened was the coverage of the Emmett Till case in 55 and the his mother's decision to let his casket be open, and Jet Magazine published a picture of his face.
That's right. You know, that image of Emmett Till and Jet, I like to say it went viral before we even had a term of like that, of saying something goes viral on social media. If you were black and of a certain age in America, you saw that image.
Yeah.
It was passed around, even if you didn't subscribe to Jet, in communities, in barbershops, from home to home, family to family. And the impact that image had on Emmett Till's generation, which was the generation of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the sit-ins, the freedom rides, And I would argue a generation of activists who, at least in Mississippi especially, I'd argue probably everywhere else, but in Mississippi were the vanguard of civil rights activism in this state and the most important activists for a period of time. And to a person, every single one of them I've ever talked to will say Emmett Till and that image forged their consciousness.
And you can, beyond even the people who were in the movement at the time, that was a continuing symbol. And even to this day, it's a symbol. Like, people can say, I remember the first time I saw that. You can ask, say, okay, when did you first see this picture? Contrast that with white Americans. And it's amazing. Now, it's probably a little different now. We have the internet. Things are a little more accessible. But I remember the first time I ever saw it was in Eyes on the Prize, when the documentary Eyes on the Prize came out in the 80s. That was the first time, I guess 87 was the first time I'd ever seen that. I had never seen that photograph before then.
I don't believe I saw it until maybe 1995, my freshman year in college. And I grew up in and around fairly progressive circles.
Right.
And you would have thought that I would have seen it. But I think for much of white America especially, they didn't even necessarily know the name Emmett Till, much less the
Correct.
Image.
People are hearing it now.
You still see them at, like, marches. They'll say a George Floyd march. A lot of times you see there are also signs that mention Emmett Till. And so he's been a continuing symbol of injustice.
And I'd also argue a sign that these incidents, if you just take from Emmett Till to George Floyd, have been ongoing and embedded in kind of systemic nature of white supremacy and racism and its brutal expressions over the last 50 years, 60 years, 70 years now since Emmett Till. And that continuum has not been, you know, just random incidents of violence perpetrated by a handful of bad actors, but instead is embedded in forces that has had a long history and trajectory in American history that are all tied together.
One of the reasons I think people are hearing about it, of course, is the Interpretive Center and some work that's being done here in trying to spread it out. There is in a building across the square from the courthouse where the two murderers were tried and found not guilty, an interpretive center and a storefront. They are about to sign, as I understand it, legal permission. They're buying, I guess, the barn itself from its local owner, and will be able to access that on a routine basis so that people can come to understand this humble building, which, of course, was portrayed in Wright Thompson's book, The Barn. That does something, I think.
Well, and of course, President Biden's executive order that established the Emmett Till National Historic Monuments across two states, Illinois and Mississippi, and right. That was a major part of it. But you're right, the work of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center and the preservation of these spaces, the power of place, and the acquisition now of the property that includes the barn, have been powerful reminders of Emmett Till and news stories that have entered into the American consciousness now.
But Jerry, in the epilogue section of your
right.
book, you talked about Dylann Roof.
Yeah.
You talked about, and that's a very particular case. You
sure.
also talked about shootings in Pittsburgh and California and the mosque burn in Texas. And then, of course, the white nationalist marches. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what you see there.
Yeah.
What you mentioned in the epilogue.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, history is basically a series, in my mind, of concentric circles. It's just, that's the way it goes. And so Dylann Roof was looking at a website before he decided to enter this church and kill those nine beautiful people. And that website was run by basically the descendant of the White Citizens Council. And so it's no surprise, you know, people that you know, fill themselves up with this kind of material then go out and act on it. It's Sam Keen wrote an excellent book years ago that's called Faces of the Enemy. And the whole idea behind the book is before we kill people with our weapons, we kill them with our minds. And I think that's so true. And I think that's what, when people, other people become monsters or they become something else like that, then people who go and try to destroy them either figuratively or literally feel like they're doing society a favor.
That seems like a very important point in the sense of either, well, like the killers of Emmett Till.
Sure.
As we, circling back to my point earlier about driving around for so long and
right.
and building up to the kidnapping, the abduction itself, and then driving him yep. around and driving the body. But also thinking about people who are indifferent to things that are going on.
Mm, true.
I mean, isn't that a form of killing them with our minds? If we sure. if we know something's going on and we're indifferent to it?
Well, it certainly speaks of our attitude toward justice or injustice. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and rooted in the dehumanization of people yes. who are different. And so that makes it, in their minds, easier, perhaps, to sure. do if they're not of, and this notion of this Christian identity that,
sure.
that, you know, anyone who's not white is not descended from Adam and Eve and is not a human.
Right.
You know, that fuels that.
It's all about identity. I mean, that's what it's really all about. Where do people get their identities? And that's all wrapped up. And when they feel like somebody else is other. I mean, for example, very simple example, Obama, the whole birth certificate thing, right? What was that really about? He's not one of us.
So it's othering.
Yeah.
To use a term I've heard.
Yeah.
Othering. Speaking of Wright Thompson's The Barn, which I evoked a few minutes ago, he talks in there about a gentleman named Von Gordon and the Alluvial Collective, which was a nonprofit sort of reconciliation center. And I think if I've got the threads of the story right, that was moved to the University of Mississippi.
Moved from it.
It was first, it was a different organization. Susan Glisson ran it.
Well, at some point it became the William Winter Institute?
It was originally the William Winter Institute.
That's right.
Okay. Is it now ceasing operation or has ceased?
It is. It's my understanding that it will be ceasing operations if it hasn't already. I think it may have already. Yes, it was founded as the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation, and the great scholar activist Dr. Susan Glisson was its founding director, and our former governor recently passed away in the last couple of years. Governor William Winter was really a figure in Mississippi history who played a key role in what seemed like a very promising time of racial reconciliation in this state. And the work that the Winter Institute did was transformative. It did eventually leave the campus of the University of Mississippi and then became the Alluvial Collective and what it evolved to. The conversations and the work that Von Gordon and Susan and the folks of the Alluvial Collective and the Winter Institute did, it was yeoman's work. They were really brokering important conversations across difference, trying to break down this othering in ways that is really hard work, but I've never seen an organization do it better than what they were doing.
Probably the best example that I know of is the Philadelphia Coalition,
right.
which they were very much behind and met with. And that organization essentially is the one that pushed for the prosecution of the Mississippi Burning case. And eventually it was.
And you're saying Philadelphia as in Philadelphia, Mississippi?
Philadelphia, Mississippi.
It's important to
I know people don't necessarily know that outside of Mississippi. That's where the three civil rights workers were killed, is in Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
So what happened to the center? I mean, it was doing this vital work, and you say it's being closed.
Well, I presume it's funding. I don't know all the story.
Yeah, I don't either, but my understanding is that it is related to funding. It is related to the changes that we are seeing at the kind of the highest levels of political power in the nation and access to funds. But I'm not one to speak, you know, really authoritatively on that decision.
Understood.
But it is a loss. I think it's a great loss to the state of Mississippi and the work in this field, not just in Mississippi, but all over the country.
I bring this up, and I understand you can't speak authoritatively, nor can I, but I bring this up having heard a little bit about it and clearly haven't gotten part of it wrong, but having heard a bit about it and thinking that what we need is more reconciliation centers, not fewer. And I don't mean that in a DEI kind of way, but I mean it in a sense of, we'll walk around to the other side of it. If we have white people who feel aggrieved and who feel like they want to march in the streets saying, you will not replace us, shouldn't we bring them in and sit down and see what motivates that and what informs it and what constructed knowledge they have and try to deconstruct it?
Absolutely. And I would argue that the single greatest antidote to that type of rage and racism is proximity to people who are different from you. And what the Winter Institute and the Alluvial Collective would do, and what Susan Glisson really espoused, was this notion of what they called the welcome table, where you could have conversation across difference and bring people in who seemingly are very different, but who can talk to each other. And when you get to actually know another human being who seems so different from you, you realize pretty quickly that they're not that different and that they're a basic nature of humanity, of what all people hope to have in their lives, and love and happiness and security, and that there is commonality that breaks down that rage. And that's what they were really good at. It's so easy for us to back away, to not engage thoughtfully in conversation around difference, even if we never agree with each other. Just engaging that conversation is so important, but it's so easy for us to stay in our small circles, our comfort zones, and never step out of that and just live in an echo chamber. And that seems to be happening more and more, especially with the advent of not really news in quotation marks.
Yeah, and one of my big complaints along those lines, I'll go ahead and air it, is we have these quote-unquote, and put quotes around it, news shows in the evening, right? Mainly in the evening, although they're pretty much on all day in most of these networks. And they're not really news shows at all. They're opinion shows. And that's my big beef, is they're just people espousing their opinion. But they're labeled as news shows. And that really confuses people, I think, instead of understanding that distinction. You used to like be required to label these things, you know, like newspapers did it for years. You know, you had the editorial page, letters to the editor, and the opposite side, they call the op-ed page, would be opinion columns. But that was understood to be separate from the news coverage. But there's not, there are no such labels distinguishing that. And I think that's a real shame.
Labeling aside, wouldn't that airing help in terms of understanding?
Oh, I'm not talking about the debate about the understanding each other. I think that's fine if people want to. But what I'm saying is it confuses, because people think that what they're hearing are facts, and they're really not facts. They're opinions.
So we do need to relabel.
I think so. I think it would be helpful. But I agree we should sit down at the table with each other. I think that's a helpful exercise. I mean, I've interviewed killers, so I've heard all sorts of things. But willingness to listen, I think, is a very helpful thing.
It doesn't seem to me like the answer to what we've been talking about today is going to come from the political circle.
No, I don't think so.
It's too adversarial.
I think politics has become almost poisonous in this nation.
And it's seen too much as a winner-take-all kind of game.
Yeah, either I win or I burn the place down.
Yeah, it's become a zero-sum game, and there's little room for compromise. And this opinion broadcast as news now fuels
exactly
that political power and allows further retrenchment into your echo chambers and into these
smaller circles. Because it reinforces what you already believe.
So I don't know how we get more of these, what do we call them? We can't call them reconciliation. We can't call them DEI. We'd have to come up with a term.
Well, welcome table is a pretty good
welcome table.
Is a pretty good term.
Yeah.
You have to have people who act in good faith, regardless of their political persuasions, regardless of kind of their belief systems, but people of good faith who are willing to come together to have these conversations and to listen. Listening, as Jerry said, is such an important part of it. Listening to people you disagree with on both sides, we need more of that. But that's hard. It's a hard ask in it's hard work. And that's one of the reasons why it feels like we're not very close to achieving that sometimes.
So maybe we should work listening table into the, you know, into the concept
table.
Too.
Yeah, listening table is a good idea as well.
Yeah, or listening booth or something. I mean, here we are in a studio.
Well, a table always is more inviting, I think
table's a good word. Yeah. And there's something, you know, of course, what was it, the Paris Accords ending the Vietnam War? It had to be a round table.
That's right.
One of the things that I think, in a sense, overlays all of this is economic disparity and political disfranchisement. So lest we, you know, pause here or quit here and say, ha, here's the magic solution, I think we have to bring in those big aspects of the problem. How big an issue is economic disparity? How about political disfranchisement? I mean, because when I was saying I don't think the solution is the political circle or sphere, that's where disfranchisement begins.
Well, it's a belief that only certain people should be allowed to vote, and that's age old in this country. It's historical, you know. So it's undoing that kind of belief that only certain people, you know, it was for what, white male property owners,
that's
I
right.
guess, when we started off and as a nation.
And, you know, the other side of that, too, is in places like Mississippi where there's deep poverty, and that poverty, there's certainly white and black poverty, but we know African Americans, the level of black poverty in the state of Mississippi outstrips almost any place in America. And the intensity of it. And that poverty also serves to disfranchise African-Americans in particular in this conversation, but poor people in general, because voting day is not a national holiday and people have to work.
It's never made sense to me. If someone is a working person, right? You know, we claim our politicians all out there claiming, oh, they represent the working person. And yet, for voting, if someone's like a working guy and works a 12-hour shift, he can't go vote.
That's right.
And I guess he can go, you know, technically go in advance and do the absentee thing. But it's just, you're making it difficult. You're making it more difficult.
That's right. And we don't have early voting in Mississippi. It's only absentee voting. And you have to have a proper excuse in order to vote.
Yeah, you can't just say, I want to vote early. That doesn't work.
So the poverty piece of it further disfranchises people and removes them from the political process. And over time, as that goes on, those same people also think that voting and political engagement is not a bread and butter issue that impacts them. And so they don't necessarily see a reason to vote.
They don't see a change.
That's right. They see no change.
So voter education becomes maybe an issue, or working with voters to get them registered and get them participating.
And I would say there are incredible organizations and good people doing that work across the state of Mississippi, but it is very hard work, especially in places like the Mississippi Delta, where access is so scarce and poverty is so deeply entrenched. It is very difficult boots on the ground work day in, day out, particularly in the years that are outside of the national election years, and when local elections and state elections, which actually people could have a greater impact on the outcomes of their day-to-day lives if they voted, but there's less interest in. And so that get out the vote work and voter education work, there are people doing it. It is just really difficult work. And you don't necessarily see the outcomes that you hope to see from it.
Do we at least not have the systemic challenges, Klansmen coming and hauling us out of our houses at night and beating us up if we're trying to register voters?
No, we just do it legally now.
That's right. We don't necessarily have Theodore Bilbo telling people that the best way to show up at their house the night before the election, if you don't want your black neighbors to go out to vote.
Robbie, you've talked about the 1890 Mississippi Constitution.
Absolutely.
talk about that for a few moments. There are some laws written there that were an example of challenges keeping people off, certain people off the rolls.
Yeah, you know, the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War is, I think, largely misunderstood and misinterpreted, and was actually a moment of quite great hope and progress in the state of Mississippi. And African Americans, who were the majority of the population in the state of Mississippi, were doing remarkable things, not just in politics. They certainly were doing that. We had two black U.S. senators from Mississippi during Reconstruction. Until Barack Obama was elected to the U.S. Senate, there had only been four total. And so we had two, the first two ever, from the state of Mississippi. But the Mississippi Constitution of 1890 in Mississippi in particular capped a decade or more of efforts to flip the script in terms of black advancement during Reconstruction and to reassert, or what they called the era of redemption post-Reconstruction, to redeem the power of white Mississippians and to reconstitute white authority over the Deep South. And so the Mississippi Constitution of 1890 would create and invent the legal framework of what we think of as Jim Crow. And when we use the words Jim Crow, I like to say that we need to talk about political power, economic power, and social power. But the political power piece in the Mississippi Constitution of 1890 was absolutely essential, because what it does is completely wipe out the political efficacy and power of African Americans, who are the majority of the population in the state of Mississippi. And it does that by creating poll taxes, $2 poll tax, residency requirements. You had to live in one place for 2 years in order to be able to vote there, and you had to pay your poll tax for every year that you lived there. Literacy exams in Mississippi was the understanding clause. You had to understand and interpret the Mississippi State Constitution to the satisfaction of a voting registrar, which was completely subjective. There were felony disfranchisement pieces of it too, that included specific crimes that were seen at the time as black crimes. In fact, the historical record tells us that the Mississippi Supreme Court said those were the crimes of what they called the more furtive race. That was the exact quote of the Mississippi Supreme Court. And it served to take a voting age population of African Americans that saw about somewhere, I believe in 1890, around an 86% voter registration rate. The voting rolls would be purged. You had to re-register to vote. And 2 years later, in 1892, that percentage is somewhere around 4% of the population. That is the majority of the population in the state. And if you can't vote, if you can't elect someone to represent you, if you can't control the laws that govern you, if you can't serve on a jury because jury rolls are taken from voter registration rolls, you have no power. And all of the other auspices of Jim Crow, segregation, disfranchisement, but also you think about the extra legal violence of lynching, all of these things are enabled by this piece of political disfranchisement. And every Southern state would copy what Mississippi did. Every Southern state that had been in the Confederacy rewrote, revised their state constitutions based on what they called the Mississippi Plan.
And the U.S. Supreme Court backed it.
That's right. Because there was a loophole in the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which is generally seen as giving African Americans the right to vote. In fact, the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution doesn't give anybody the right to vote. It simply says the right to vote cannot be denied or abridged based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And so the Mississippi Constitution of 1890, what these redeemers, these white supremacist political leaders figured out was, well, a poll tax doesn't say anything on the surface about race. Literacy exams don't say anything on the surface about race. And so the U.S. Supreme Court upheld it in a case that is little known but incredibly influential, called Williams versus Mississippi. And I would argue in the 1890s, probably more important than Plessy versus Ferguson.
This all sort of adds up to an attitude of or an environment, I think, that's kind of discouraging, which is furthered by recent news. The former police officer who was convicted of shooting into Breonna Taylor's apartment. The Justice Department has suggested to the trial judge or the sentencing judge that the officer receive a penalty of 1 day, which essentially is time served, because it's the time after his arrest. I mean, that's got to send a message. Even if you read the fine print, I mean, in today's news world, nobody's out there in the world is going to have the opportunity to sit and read the fine print of the argument for doing it that way, about he's lost his job, he's lost his career, he'll never have a gun permit. Okay, but still in all,
and
that's a chilling effect.
Yeah, Breonna Taylor lost her life. And so the great miscarriage of justice is, again, a story that you can find throughout American history and not just in this current day. And so what you're seeing is a reflection of a long history that leads up to this. And it comes back to this. It's that ebb and this flow where we see the progress and the regression, the progress and the regression.
Which makes me feel that to make real progress, we need to regress less.
and I would argue that we actually do regress less than we advance. And so the fact that the three of us can sit here and have this conversation in Jackson, Mississippi, without worrying about the moment we walk out this door being assassinated, that's not something we could have done 50 or 60 years ago. We could have done this, but we would have known walking in that we were taking our lives in our own hands just to do it. And so there has been progress. I would say, and I've seen civil rights veterans activists talk about this notion that we haven't made progress is a slap in the face to those activists who risked and gave their lives demanding that this nation live up to its ideals, live up to this ideal that all people are created equal, not just all men, all people are created equal, and that democracy is something that is worth saving and engaging and makes us different as a nation and better.
Well, that is the thing about democracy. I mean, it is an ongoing experiment. And we are perfecting it as we go, or reinventing it as we go.
Yeah, perfecting may not be the right word.
Yeah, perfecting is not the word that comes to mind.
Reinventing and trying to perfect or trying to improve?
Well, and, you know, I would say very clearly there are people who don't want to improve democracy, who want to limit democracy. And they say it very, very clearly in how they don't want people to have access to the polls. They want low voter turnout. They want only the right kind of people in their mind, quote unquote, right kind of people showing up.
Who oftentimes are the people who will keep them in power.
That's exactly right.
Because it is somewhat about power.
Well, it's always about power. I mean, that's what we, you know, historically within this country, it's unfortunately a lot of our history is about power.
And I would argue that power throughout American history has been built particularly upon racialized violence. The founding fathers, their power was rooted in their roles as slaveholders. You know, we think about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, all people whose wealth and status was built upon the backs of people of African descent who were enslaved.
Well, they certainly were men of a certain class.
That's right.
They were privileged.
Yeah.
No question.
And those enslaved people helped to build this nation. And none of them, I would also argue, none of them wanted to be enslaved, and that they were always fighting for freedom and for recognition of their dignity and rights as human beings.
Well, gentlemen, I think we'll leave it on that note, although I don't think we've come up with the ideal solution. At least we've identified some issues and problems. Any closing words?
I'm not sure there is an ideal solution. I would just say I'm grateful for the good work of people like Jerry and so many others across the state and so many fields and across this nation who are committed to the ideal of equality and justice and democracy. And that is work that is ongoing, and I'm grateful for that.
We are in Mississippi, but, you know, Faulkner said to understand any place, you have to understand Mississippi. But the other thing I would bring back to where we began, which is that as we build knowledge, we replace previous knowledge. We deconstruct knowledge. I thank you for joining me today and trying to build knowledge in our listeners' minds and adding to that. Even if they're not in Mississippi, I think maybe they'll have a Faulknerian experience. I hope anyway, they'll have a Faulknerian experience and we can build some new knowledge that they will understand wherever they live and whatever they're seeing and understanding going on in their communities. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.